Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk. Twice weekly, we do a podcast, and it's for people who play with thread.
Oh, no.
How's that? How's that,
that's
huh?
That's not our tagline.
Oh, that's all right. Not, needles. No. Needles, too.
There we go.
And cloth and charts and patterns and those things. And
wire. Today we're going to talk about wire.
Wire. Yeah, people who play with wire. And we have one of the best wire players in the world here. Celeste Chalasani joining us to talk about stump work and other things. Hi, Celeste.
Hi, Gary. Hi, Christine.
Hello.
That's going on her resume. I play with wire.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, it's not inaccurate.
And I use sharp tools, too.
I like that.
An element of danger, yes.
Excellent. So, I, for anybody who has been listening at all, because sometimes we'll talk about, you know, what it is for stitching, Celeste is the teacher of the Craftsy class that I am stitching at the moment, which is how we got started thinking about this. So, that's how we came to you. And I'm actually working on the piece right now as we speak. So, that's pretty cool.
Great.
Yeah, this is the jealousy part where Christine gets to sit and stitch and talk, and I have to sit here and watch sound spectra
levels
on the screen and all kinds of things. Yeah, but she just sits there and stitches. Yeah, it's kind of unfair.
So are you working on wired petals right now?
I am. That's exactly what I'm doing. So, right. So, okay. So let's catch up. So the piece is a Craftsy piece. We've talked about the Craftsy classes, their video and a little bit of PDF, and this particular piece is a stump work piece of poppies and Santa Barbara daisies and a bumblebee, and it's a beautiful piece. So that's how I wanted to start stump work, and I was kind of fiddling with books a little bit, and felt like I needed just a tiny bit of instruction of just somebody showing me what they're doing, and so someone had suggested to check out the Craftsy class, which I did, and said this is a great opportunity to get a little bit of guidance, and so I started the piece. So,
well, I'm glad you're enjoying the class, and that's what it's intended for, is to help people who are interested in stump work to get them over that hurdle of I've got this book, how do I go from here?
Right. Yeah, and I think because needlepoint, you know, things like that, you pick up the chart, they're usually, you know, some instructions are better than others. I started with a Debbie Rowley piece, and her charts are, you know, the instructions are so detailed that I was able to follow along that by myself very easily. And then you get to something like a Jane Nicholas stump workbook, and the instructions are great for somebody that has done it before because it has all the guidance to create those things. But when you're starting out completely, without having someone stitching in front of you showing you, okay, this is how the wire gets laid down and this is what it should look like, it was a little challenging. So
yeah, definitely.
So tell us how you got started with Craftsy and stump work and in general.
Well, in general, how I got started with stump work was I joined the Embroiderers Guild, and I walked into a meeting one day and someone had Jane Nicholas's books sitting on the table.
Uh-oh.
And I looked at it and I said, okay, I got to do this. So we brought in a teacher and she taught us a little tiny ladybug. Mm-hmm. And I was hooked. And then in terms of the Craftsy class, the Linda Perlman was my category manager at the time. She contacted me and said, would you be willing just to talk to me, to let me tell you about Craftsy and see if you would be interested? And at the time, I didn't know who Craftsy was, but my daughter did. And she said, oh, Mom, you got to talk to her at least. You got to talk to her. So I talked to Linda and found out about Craftsy and said, yeah, this would be a good opportunity and a good way to reach people.
Mm-hmm.
So, but now I want to back up a little bit because you joined the Embroidery Guild. So you've been stitching something or other for some time, what it says in your bio, since you were a kid. So
Yeah.
Is it primarily embroidery that you were doing that all along
Well,
that
my grandmother taught me originally how to do some basic embroidery stitches, and I probably started the same way women of my age did, where you got the stamped embroidered pillowcases.
Right. Uh-huh.
And
Oh,
you
yeah.
embroidered over them. Yeah. I mean, it's every woman that I've talked to of my age, that's how we all got started. And then when I was in high school, I did some cross stitch. And when my kids were babies, I did a little bit more cross stitch. And then I put it down because, you know, when you have kids and you're working, you don't always have much time to do anything. Mm-hmm. And then as they got a little bit older, then I wanted to get back into it. But I have to say that I can't count anymore. So I can't do counted work like I used to do. Is my brain just doesn't function that way anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And people laugh and say, sure, you can count. And it's like, yeah, I can count to like two. And after that, it's a problem.
Yep. So you go, as Arlene says, off the grid. You just go freehand.
Off the grid.
Yeah, it's all off the grid for me now.
Now, you did a piece. I got to get this question in because I've had this opportunity and keep forgetting to ask the question. And you've done some historical research on stump work. So I have to know, where does the word stump work come from? Because it doesn't, to the layperson, doesn't make a lick of sense.
Okay, originally in the 17th century, the technique was called raised embroidery. So it was.
Now, see, that makes sense. Why don't we stay with that?
So it was at its height between 1650 and the late 17th century. And then sometime, like I think in the 18th century, someone coined this term. And they're not really sure if it refers back to the phrase en stamp. That's French, or if it refers to the fact that they used carved faces and carved hands in the original raised embroidery. It came up in a reference as stump work. So there's no specific way to trace it back to why they came up with that term.
So the original stump work then, what were those pieces used for?
Well, the original raised embroidery was done primarily by little 12-year-old girls, and it was the culmination of their needlework education. So they would learn all these other techniques, and then at the end of it, they would do a raised embroidery piece. And primarily, it was done on what they called caskets, which are really very elaborate mm-hmm. boxes, and or on mares. And the girls would produce the embroidery that would go on these boxes. And mostly it was scenes with people and with animals and flowers and insects, but nothing was to scale.
So this stump work then, stump work in those caskets, which is another weird use of a term in our day anyway. So these were kind of like the grad school for the reproduction samplers that the girls did.
Right, exactly.
Oh.
So it didn't have it didn't have an exact purpose. Like, you know, crewel work, they did a lot of hanging curtains, and they did bed covers and pillows and stuff like that. Black work, they did a lot of clothing. But with stump work, it was all decorative.
Hmm.
Yeah, because it doesn't really, it's delicate, and because everything is raised, that you really couldn't use it for clothing. It would not be very functional.
Exactly.
So it really would have to be just a, and now would this be something that would be limited to maybe the upper class
Definitely.
Girls? Just because even now, looking into the cas-, we were just talking to somebody actually who was working on a casket as a class, mm-hmm. and I looked into the class, and it was very expensive because the casket itself, to have it built by a master, a woodworker, it was pretty expensive to do.
Right.
And then to all the embroidery and materials that would go into covering this, So if you Google, not you, but, you know, generally people Google embroidered casket, it's really worth doing because they're absolutely beautiful and they're right. nothing like you've ever seen before.
Right. And not many are still in existence because the plague hit at the same time that these were.
Yes.
And so a lot of the schools were in London. And when the plague hit London, they burned everything.
Right, because that was the only way of controlling the disease.
Exactly.
So
this, yeah, this is now this is a whole new dimension for me now, because it, you know, we look at needlepoint and cross stitch and all those things, and then you look back in the history, and I mean, it's been such an education as we've talked to reproduction sampler people to learn the importance of those samplers in little girls' lives and in their uh-huh. future, and then to uh-huh. to now learn that stump work was the advanced stage of that is
right.
Wow.
And the scenes that were on the panels that they did, most of the time they were scenes from the Bible that were to teach the young girls lessons of morality as well.
Hmm. So as an education thing and everything here, everything.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Right. Wrapping everything together. Yeah, it is interesting. And I have friends who are Shakespeare scholars. So same time period. And mm-hmm. it's always been interesting to me to, as I'm learning sort of the history of the needlework, looking particularly in that time frame, because now it has a context for me, you know, because while the theater was going on and all the different things that were going on in London at the time, you know, to look at that and then to look at, you know, the black work on the costumes, which would have been from the aristocracy being, you know, whatever their discards were, would go to the theater. So those would be perfect pieces where you would see lots of embroidery done.
Mm-hmm.
So to wrap all of these things together, and then the way I got started with stump work was exactly the same way. We were talking to Nordic Needle, and they mentioned Jane's Shakespeare Flowers book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so immediately I looked that up, and then that was how I got hooked, because that book is absolutely stunning. And I said,
oh,
I need
is.
To do this. So yeah. It wraps all of, you know, the things that are my favorite things together into one thing. So
now what I want you to remember is that what we do now has evolved from what was done in the 17th century. So in the 17th century, you had surface embroidery, but the raised stitches were primarily variations of detached buttonhole stitch,
mm-hmm.
so a type of needle lace. And once Jane Nicholas started researching, and before she came out with her first book, she adapted and developed a method, and that's how we attach the wire onto fabric now.
Right.
So in the 17th century, the historical side doesn't have the wired slips that are attached to fabric. The wired slips at that point were detached buttonhole stitch on wire.
Hmm. Interesting. So, right. So are there any, do you know of any books that are good reference for that, for being able to see that sort of work and how they're different?
Well, one of my favorite authors is Barbara and Rory Hurst. And they produced two books, and their style is more the historical style.
Because I think it would be interesting to do a piece each way, you know,
yes.
to do it sort of Jane's modern, you know, adaptation versus going back and doing it the old style and sort of seeing how those two things compare.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that primarily what you miss with the old style is the shading.
Mm.
So,
okay.
You know how you do the long and short stitch so that mm-hmm. the flowers look really natural? That's the biggest difference to me.
In that the shading is not done as much today?
In that it's really difficult to get any kind of shading when you're doing detached buttonhole stitch.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Not the same way that you can do it with long and short stitch.
Mm-hmm. Because that's what, Christine, yeah. that's what you're working on that poppy was, we talked about that yeah. the other day, the long and short stitch
mm-hmm.
in that to get that
right.
shading. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And it seems like, so I, of course, now I'm looking at the Roy and Barbara Hearst books, and it's interesting because the subjects are different. So they're doing a lot of people.
Exactly.
Where the, I think now we're doing more sort of botanical and natural right. subjects.
Right.
But to do the people is really kind of interesting. There's another book that I like that's been a good reference, which is, let's see, I have it in front of me, the Kate Sinton book, which is yes. one of the Royal School's Essential Stitch Guides. There, yes. Her stump work book is really great because it breaks down each step, and then she does a piece at the end that has a person. And
yes.
when you think about it, a person would be, you know, we any other styled needlework, you do very stylized versions of people, right? Or they're flat mm-hmm. and two-dimensional. And this is the
right.
exact opposite, and maybe more towards what the Hearst style is, because it's needle lace. It's all of it. It's using, you know, pieces of wood and other found materials mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. create a really three-dimensional person.
And I think Kate Sinton's instructions for creating the face
mm-hmm.
are better than Barbara and Roy Hearst's instructions.
The instructions are phenomenal. They really
yeah.
are.
Yeah. And the face looks more realistic than what you see in other books that have the similar instruction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
So this whole community of stump work people is fairly small then, huh?
Oh yeah, it's very much a niche market.
Yeah, but I mean, just the when I mean, pretty much sounds to me like we've named kind of the key people in carrying this through to today, and in Jane making it a more modern look, and that's about it. It's just
well, I think Jane is responsible for reviving the interest in it.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Because you know, with what she did, I mean, she kind of revolutionized how to do the flowers. And mm-hmm. I mean, that's what sold me, was how realistic
yes.
you can make them look.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everybody loves what she does.
Yeah.
Hard not to.
It is. So, yeah. So as a teacher then, because it's so niche and because there aren't a lot of people doing it, do you find it's harder to book and fill classes, or there's less demand for it versus doing like painted canvas teaching?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely. I rarely will have a full class.
And why do you think that is? Do you think it's just intimidating because it's so different?
You know, when I talk to people, like, you know, they'll do the teacher showcases at the different seminars, and mm-hmm. and I'll talk to different people, and people will come and they'll say, I love what you do, but I could never do that. And the thing is with stump work, if you break it down into parts, it's not nearly as hard as it looks like it's going
to
be.
Yeah, I would agree. And that's a hard thing to listen to, because then my inclination is to say, well, you don't know until you try, right? And
yeah.
You know, you can try. And one of the nice things about, you know, doing wired slips is if you have to make 9 petals, draw 12 and then pick mm-hmm. the best ones, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
So not everyone is going to come out perfect, but also, but it's just like anything else, you know, this is really my first, you know, even just any surface stitching embroidery. It's the first, any kind of needle painting. It's the first stump work at all of these are first, and none of it is perfect. But I can see progression, right? So the first petal
right.
is kind of rough and not so,
yeah.
You know, not like not didn't come out like yours, you know, and especially
but,
like that. What was surprising was the buttonhole. Getting the buttonhole stitch perfect around the edge was a lot harder than I thought. But that said, by the time I get to the fifth one, it's getting to be pretty routine, and you
yeah.
find sort of a rhythm and little tricks
uh-huh.
to get everything to lay flat. And then you're right. It's like, well, this isn't really as difficult as I thought. It's just
right.
kind of jumping in and practicing, you know,
The thing to remember with surface embroidery, too, is that how you stitch is not going to be the way I stitch, which is not going to be the way as anyone else stitches.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, when my perception of doing canvas work or counted work is that when you're following instructions and you're doing the stitch the way it's supposed to be done, you can pretty much duplicate one person's work to another person's work. But with surface embroidery, everybody has a slightly different hand. So like yes. when you're doing that first row of long and short, it's not going to be exactly how long mine is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so everyone's is unique.
Yes. Yes. And that's okay. That's nice.
And
so
that's great. I mean,
yeah.
I don't want my work to be exactly like somebody else's. I want mm-hmm. it to be my own.
Yeah. So this is interesting because we talk about perfection a lot. And so Gary and I are probably as opposite in style, I think, as you can be, because Gary is very much about doing it perfect and having it. And that's his goal, is to have it perfect. So this style, I can imagine Gary, and he's being very quiet now, you know, Hi. Sort of jumping in off the grid where you're not going to be able to perfectly replicate your model, and that's okay. So becoming, you know, comfortable with creating something that is not an exact replica, but is, you know, approximately and is inspired by, but isn't going to be the same.
Well, you look at two flowers are never the same.
Right. Right.
That's how I look at it. And even if I do six petals today and I do six petals with the exact same colors and the exact same shapes of the wire and all that, the six petals tomorrow are not going to look the same as I did today, just because I'm a different person. You know, it
yes.
all depends on how did I sleep? What else has been going on in my life? You know?
Right. Right, right. And I think that's good, though, because no flower petal, even on the same flower, is exactly the same. There's always going to be little variations. And I think that's what creates the realism of it, is
uh-huh,
that
definitely.
Is that there isn't perfection, right? If it's exactly the same, it starts to look robotic, right?
Right.
So
right.
those little variations, you embrace them.
Exactly.
See, so it's okay to be not perfect, Gary.
Okay, noted. Noted. No, but I think
he doesn't believe me.
That's because I bought a Jane Nicholas book and I have a package of wires and I started reading it and I want to learn and I want to do it because I want to build those things.
Okay.
But I think there is that psychological thing that that's a hurdle that I have to get over, is that willingness to just dive in and let it be what it is. And then let the next one be a little better or certainly different. And I think that for me, who, and I, you know, I'll admit it, I'm a perfectionist. I like it to be spot on every time. And that element of that variability, I guess it is, that is in this, I think is what intimidates me a little bit and has made me spend a lot of time reading and studying the works of others, but not willing to pick up needle and couch down a wire and start doing it. And it's, you know, I think it really is that there's some of that. I've kind of been studying my mind over this because Christine has just dove in and I've been kind of vicariously picking her brain and learning from her in terms of what she's doing. And, but to pull the trigger is a really kind of a bit of a leap for me to do, because it just there's something about it. There's a little wall there that I have to get over.
Well, if it makes you feel better, the way that I'm learning is by screwing up.
No, I know.
And that's what a lot of us do.
Yeah, so it's by doing something and saying, well, that doesn't look very good, and then moving on to something else and trying something different, you know? Like one of the things that I learned, so we're talking about couching wires down and doing buttonhole stitch, was the first one that I did. Every time I tried to stitch it, the thread was fraying really badly.
Okay.
And I couldn't figure out why. So, okay, I'm working with shorter lengths of thread, so it doesn't fray, but it was really frustrating. And then I kind of just put it down and looked at it from a distance and realized I was trying to be so precise with getting the buttonhole stitch to hug the wire perfectly. that what was happening is I was just dragging the thread against every, like the entire way around the wire and pulling it so tight that it was just a braiding. So
tight.
So
okay.
Just right. It was too tight. So just by allowing the stitch to sit just, you know, half a millimeter away from the wire, as opposed to just against it, all of the difference in the world. And it didn't, you know, it's not so far away that the buttonhole stitch is no longer holding the wire. It's all holding fine. It's just, I had to let go a little bit and just kind of relax.
Okay.
And then once I did that, then I don't have any of the fraying at all, and it's fine.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So it's just kind of, you know, making mistakes and seeing what doesn't work and moving on. That's and not ripping things out. Right. So I look at the piece and I'm like, I know this isn't right and I'm going to leave it because this will be my first piece so that a year from now I can look at it and say, wow, that isn't as good as what I did yesterday. So I have to resist the urge to rip it out and redo it and let the next piece be the better one.
And let's just say that taking buttonhole stitch out
over
the wire is
no,
is crazy time.
Yeah, that's why I make 12 instead of 9.
Yeah.
Celeste, when you first encountered stump work, was it, did it hook you so bad, like everything else goes aside, I got to learn how to do this? And you just pound away at it till you start to really get it?
What I actually had to do was I knew at the time that I didn't know enough stitches.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up doing a individual correspondence course through EGA on Jacobean Crewel, just so that I could learn the stitches first.
Okay.
So I went that route before I really tried to do many projects.
Okay.
And that makes sense because a lot of the stitches they're the same. They're just in different materials and much finer than doing them in wool.
Right.
Right.
And crewel is a great way to learn because you're using this big, heavy Appleton wool. And the stitches are much easier and it goes much faster.
Right.
So
there's good overlap there.
Right. And then once I learned that, then I felt comfortable going back and really focusing on stump work.
Okay. There's a process there. I just, you know, some people just go at it bullheaded till they get it. I wondered if you had a method there. And then when did you start designing? I mean, you must have worked quite a while to get proficient enough that you felt you could create your own designs, or were your own designs a way to create things to learn on?
Well, when I took the City and Guilds courses, basically the way those were, one of the first ones, the tutor said, go out and pick out a flower and trace the petal. Match your colors and stitch your flower. So with that coursework, you were kind of thrown into designing your own pieces. It's sink or swim, basically.
No kidding. Wow. With the real deal, too. Mama Nature right in your hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that was one of the things I thought that was interesting about the way that you talked about designing was actually tracing a flower, you know, between the photography and the tracing. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that was, I think that's the first time listening to sort of that description that I felt with any needlework that I said, you know what, I think I could do that. I think I could design a piece using your approach.
Okay, so basically when I'm looking at a flower and I want to do it, usually it's something that I have access to where I can actually pick a flower. And so I will go and I will pick a flower and one that's kind of in the prime of its life. You don't want to pick one that's on a death door, but you go and you pick it and I match the colors right away. And then I will take each petal off and I will trace each petal. And during that process, I will take photographs of the flower from different angles. And I'll take, like, say the fuchsia, because the fuchsia is probably one that I'm going to be working on next. I have a hanging fuchsia basket, so I'll take pictures of the fuchsia from different angles and then cut the flower off, match colors so I know what kind of colors I'm working with, and then trace each petal. And that's basically how I can make a wired slip.
That's pretty great. Yeah, and that's such a great way to do it, because, again, you're talking about the anxiety of designing from scratch. There's that element of, I'm not an artist, so I can't draw. But
exactly.
By doing it this way, you still have to be able to, you know, compose it back together and everything. But if you're tracing the actual thing, if nothing else, you know, you're going to have to interpret it, but it's a lot less anxiety provoking because you feel like you have a good guide, which is the actual item.
Right. And, I mean, sometimes you have to make adjustments, you know, especially if it's, you're looking at it and you're seeing the three-dimensional, but you have to think about it in terms of you're going to have a background fabric. So where it might normally have four petals sticking out, you have to eliminate one of the petals, or one of those petals needs to be worked on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes some adjustment, but if you start first where you're tracing all the petals, that's the perfect way to start.
Yeah, that sounds a lot less intimidating, I think, than just drawing it, you know, straight. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, like, with the lotus that I'm working on right now, I look at it in terms of, if you've seen the pictures on Instagram, I've got mm-hmm. some that are done on the surface itself. You have to think in terms, too, of how many wired slips do you want to do?
Also a good point, because you don't want to get stuck in that. And what I like about that piece, too, is that most of the stump work that I've seen has been done on, you know, light-colored fabrics, light mm-hmm. backgrounds. And that, and of course, when I saw it, I was like, this makes perfect sense, but I never would have thought about it. It's on a dark blue background, which is where you would expect, you know, it. So it gives you that water sort mm-hmm. of impression, and it's beautiful. And seeing it done, you say, oh, well, of course, that makes perfect sense. But I never would have thought to do that, you know, but it gives you that illusion of depth underneath those flowers,
yeah.
too.
That's what I was working towards.
Yeah. Well, you did. You nailed it. That's
great,
really
thank
pretty.
You.
So it's fun to watch that piece coming together as well.
What
Gary,
is
Gary, you had a question.
Yeah, I had when I bought the Jane Nicholas book, at Nordic mm-hmm. Needle, then their software suggested this, you know, this wire that, you know, most people buy this wire. So I bought it's a white covered white wire package of eight
okay.
or something like that. Are there,
okay.
But the real question is, when it comes to what Christine and I call infrastructure, are there some standard wires and things that anybody should have on hand to do this work?
Okay, so I use...
And you're going to say it depends, I know, but...
yeah, it depends on how much you want to get into it. So if you are just starting out and you don't want to use a lot of funds just to get started, because you don't know if you're going to really dive into it like I have, you can use a beading wire, like a 28-gauge unwrapped beading wire, and mm-hmm. that will work. And the big box stores sell that. You can use a 32 gauge wrapped wire that's floral. It's a floral wire that you can buy at the big box stores. What I use is 33 gauge wrapped wire that comes from Japan. And there's two companies, one's on the East Coast and one's in Canada, that sells it, and it comes in 50 pieces to the package. What I do is I found a place in Japan where I can get 200 pieces at a time, and that's what I kit with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the 33 gauge is slightly smaller, and it's a very nice wrap to it.
So it's the quality and not just the size that is appealing
yes.
to you about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you're first getting started, I would say start with the 28 gauge unwrapped or the 32 gauge.
Okay.
But if you can, I would order from the cake suppliers. They're on the East Coast or in Canada.
Cake as in baking cake?
Yes, cake as in baking cake.
Okay.
Yeah, I think they use it for, because I used to do, and as another hobby, because I don't have enough hobbies, they use it for the stamens for flowers a lot of times, that little wire. It's very, very fine wire.
Mm-hmm. It is. And it's a really good quality.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting how we branch out from local needlework store and needlework suppliers to get what we need. Yeah.
And so, then you're gonna need a good quality wire cutters that you go down to the Home Depot and just buy a pair of wire cutters. Mm-hmm. So you don't need special wire cutters, you know, like beading cutters or anything like that. You just need a basic pair of wire cutters.
Okay.
And then you're doing most things either on stretcher bars or hooped then, right? Not as...
I have started using Evertights.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I really love the Evertight frame.
I think that's the going consensus is that the Evertights are really nice.
They keep popping up. It's like they're, mm-hmm. I mean, they've been around for a while, but it's like they're gaining momentum with those things that I've never used one, but I have never talked to anyone who doesn't think that they are just really nice.
Well, especially for stump work, you don't want to have to be taking a hoop on and off all the time, because it changes your tension. So with the Evertights, you can leave it on and you don't have to worry about taking it off.
Mm-hmm.
And if your fabric loosens up for whatever reason, you can tighten it back up.
And so, do they have a pretty good range once you, I mean, you put the fabric on as tight as you can, and then do they have a pretty decent range, like what, a quarter inch, a half inch of stretch?
I don't think it has that much.
Okay.
I use the same size frame as what my pieces are cut for.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll tighten up a little bit, but not half an inch.
Okay. Yeah, I just didn't know how long the bolts were that you turned to spread the things. But so there's like maybe an eighth of an inch or so then.
Yeah. At the most, I would say an eighth of an inch.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, sometimes though that makes the difference. And one of the things that I've found is that, especially with this, like, you know, with other things, I can get away with having the fabric tight, but if it's not drum tight, it's, you know, you can manage, right? Mm-hmm. And with this, having it be super, super tight has been such a help for me.
Really, especially with the wired slips.
Yep, absolutely. And actually what I'm using for this, just because it happened to be what I have, and I had no idea that it was going to work as well as it did. So for the larger piece, I'm using a wrapped hoop. So I just wrapped it like you would wrap any other hoop. For the slips, I happen to have a little 3-inch plastic hoop that I just had. And what they have is they have a ridge on the inner, on the underneath the inner hoop. So when you snap it on, the fabric folds into that and it just makes it really tight. It makes it very easy to get it tight. So looking at a plastic hoop, I never would have thought that you could get that good performance out of it. But you can really get, I mean, the fabric is really super tight in that. And that's, I never would have thought that. I would have thought that a plastic hoop would be pretty terrible.
And is that one that has the spring load on the bottom one, or is that one with the bolt on top?
It's a bolt and screw. So you snap it on and the fabric wraps around that little ridge that's on the inner hoop. And then you can tighten it down a lot. So you tighten it down, you can pull the fabric and it just seems to hold almost as well. So the difference between like an unwrapped versus a wrapped wooden hoop, when it's unwrapped, the fabric slides back and forth.
Right.
This ridge doesn't let the fabric slide. So once you pull it, it stays tight.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I just happened to get it as a – I think I bought it just a sort of a lot of old hoops, and some of them are the old fashioned spring kind, which are mm-hmm. really not useful for anything.
Yeah,
isn't that the truth?
They're not. I mean, maybe they'll be good display things. I don't know, but you can't get any tension on them at all. But I was surprised. This little plastic thing that was probably 50 cents is like one of my favorite tools now because it's just
that's good.
Yeah, I just get such good tension, and to get the slip that tight really makes it so much easier.
And you want to make sure you don't use the really cheap bamboo style hoops.
Yeah, yeah.
Those don't tighten at all.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, boy, I think we've all learned that lesson. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's like anything else. Spend good money on good equipment. You'll be happy.
Definitely. Yeah.
Talk about the Craftsy class. Now, the Craftsy, that's a massive operation in relative terms.
Oh, it is.
And especially if you don't have a store or a place to go to a class, a live class, a really economical way to learn a lot of things. Talk about how you got involved in that and what it's like to put together a class and to teach a class.
Well, it's... if you think about it in terms of when you develop a class like to teach live, you know, you're proposing 18 months in advance. And if you're just proposing with a sketch, you've got at least 6 months before you need to have the model stitched. And then basically you have another year to write the instructions. So you have a lot of time. I had basically about 6 weeks to stitch the model and basically come up with an outline of how we were going to film the class. And we said that for each lesson, we were going to focus on a specific part of what stump work is. So there's one that's on dimensional stitches. There's one that's on padded slips. And there's a couple different lessons on different types of wired slips. And there's a lesson on how you attach and finish the piece. And then the producer wanted to have one lesson that's at the beginning that's an introduction that talks about stump work and talks about the materials that we were going to use. So going in to film the class, we had this framework of what we were going to cover for each lesson. And it's just like shooting a movie, I guess. You go in, you have an idea of what you're going to say, what you need to cover, and I had to have, if I was going to work on wired slips, I needed to have all the materials ready to work on wired slips.
And then you have a lapel mic, and then two or three cameras at different places filming.
Yes. Right. So they had a camera that I could face to for when I was talking to the student. Mm-hmm. And then they had cameras at different angles to where they could get one that was directly above me and one that's to the side. Hmm. So that they could get the really close up video while I was working. So it was a wonderful experience. And I hope at some point I'll get to do another class. And the thing that I really love about it is that for everyone who can't go and take a class in person, you know, for whatever reasons, whether it's financial or family or career or whatever, this gives them the opportunity to learn something like stump work.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you record film all the lessons in two or three day span, or how did that work?
It was over 3 days.
Uh-huh. Long and days, I'll bet.
Yeah, basically working 8-hour days.
Uh-huh.
But it was a lot of, in order to be able to do it in those 3 days, it was a lot of prep getting up to there.
Well, yeah. I can imagine. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, because there's a lot of places where it's, you know, where you talk about, okay, here's how you start this section. And then you say, and I'll be right back. And when I finish the section. So now, of course, you had to have had the second part finished.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine how many pieces you came in. So you came in with the finished piece and then, you know, 10 ones at different stages of finished.
Yes. But, and the producer needed to know what I was going to be doing and how I was going to be doing it so he could direct the cameraman to tell him, okay, this is what I'm going to be doing. So you need to be filming from above or you need to be filming from the side or whatever. And then they had a tech guy there who's basically handling the three cameras and the mic all at one time and doing the initial editing.
Oh, wow. So well, and Christine, you've been through at least a couple of these now. I mean, it's must be a really easy to follow professional video that you're looking at then.
Yes, absolutely. It's completely professionally done. And so as I'm watching it, I have a few thoughts. One is that, you know, it's just a great way to learn something because you have not only the video and just, you know, the stitch guide and everything, but then there's conversations that go on underneath each lesson. So you can ask a question, make a comment, you can interact with it. It's not just a one-way conversation. Which is great because then if you do have a question, you can just pop in and ask and then Celeste will come back and answer or, you know, post this is where I am and things like that. But then also, you know, thinking about it, you know, having done teaching of other things, to sit there for 3 days, talk about being nervous.
Yeah, it's nerve-wracking. And you have to learn how to talk and stitch at the same time.
Yes, it strikes me as that must have been really difficult to do because you're not, you know, and it's also easy. So Gary and I, in our previous life, we would do lectures and teach in front of large groups of people. But the great thing about it was you teach the class and then you're done. So, you know, if you misstep, you say a word wrong, you forget something, you don't go in the order you want, it's no big deal because it's done and it's off into the ether and it's never to be seen again, except for the rare one that's actually been videotaped that I yes. have and that I will never, ever watch. Right. But here this is in perpetuity. It's there. So you have to get it, you know, have to get it pretty perfect.
Yeah. And, you know, there's mistakes and if somebody points out a mistake, you say, oops, yep. That's didn't do that and this is what you should be doing, and you know there's nothing that you can do about it because your 3 days of being filmed and all that are done.
So how does it as the class is going on, Celeste, how are you interacting with the students? Do you get notification when a question is posted?
I log in every day. And they have a platform for the instructors where we can go, and it says manage my class. And I can go in and I can see if someone has posted a question or posted a discussion item. And then I can go and I can see what it is, and then I can reply to that.
Okay. So you're staying up with it on a daily basis. So if I'm a student and I have a question, not much more than 24 hours is going to go by and I'm going to have something back from you.
Yes. Now, if something happens, like if I'm going to be gone, I can post an announcement and say, I'm traveling and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. And, or if I go online and there's not a question and then, you know, there's a computer glitch or whatever, and I miss something, I will get a notification that there's activity in my class.
Okay.
And so that's the extra prod if I miss something.
And these classes, I can sign up tomorrow for the same class Christina's taking.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just an ongoing thing. It's not like there's a start date or anything like that.
No, there's no expiration. If you buy a class, it's yours forever.
Okay.
So you have students at each stage. So right now you have students that are just purchasing materials and you have students who are finishing the piece. So that must be a little bit more fun for you too, because you get to sort of address, you know, you're not all working on the same thing at the same time.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's kind of fun. Yeah. I think that would be.
And I love seeing students' progress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, that's really exciting, seeing people as they are going through the project and then And then, you know, I'll post their finished pieces on my Facebook page. And everybody loves seeing what they've done.
Yeah. Well, especially with this stuff. This, you complete something like this, that's really something to hold up to show people. Yeah.
Do you think that a lot of the students are completely new to embroidery like this, or do you think more are, you know, have some experience with other styles, you know, and are picking this up some years into their sort of training?
I've had a mix of people.
Yeah.
I've had some that already had done some stump work. I think those were at the very beginning. And then I've had some that were completely new to embroidery.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, and you know, I'm happy with how everybody has been doing. You know, everyone who is actually working through the project has done really well.
Yeah, the pictures that have been posted are really impressive, because I guess, well, I mean, it depends on your makeup, right? If you're a little intimidated, you could look at them and say, wow, everybody's doing those really well. I'm never going to be able to do that. But on the other hand, you could look at them and say, wow, if everybody else is able to get this level of competence, uh-huh, then, you know, I should just try, because it's probably uh-huh going to be great. Uh-huh. And I think that's kind of how I've been looking at it. You know, there's a lot of, and you're right, every piece is a little bit different, you know, especially because the piece has a lot of leaves, and the leaves are kind of, you know, because poppy leaves are a little jagged,
uh-huh,
nobody's leaves are the same. And I
right
love that.
And it doesn't have to be perfect.
No. And I love that everyone's is a little bit different. And I like also seeing that people are adding little things, you know, uh-huh, like adding a little, a different insect, or changing something a little bit. That's fun too. You know, because it shows that somebody has enough confidence to be able to say, okay, I can do this, and I'm gonna twist it a little bit to make it something that I like.
Yeah, exactly.
How does this compare to live teaching? Better, worse, different?
It's very different, because when you're teaching live, you're giving a lesson and you see immediate feedback. So mm-hmm you can see the person. And if you're teaching 20 students, and one person is not getting it, you can see on their face that they didn't get something there. And so you can immediately go and talk to them and help them. And when I'm teaching, I'm going around and I'm looking at what they're doing, and I'm giving them feedback right away. But with the online class, I can't see what the student is doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to wait for them to ask questions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so as always, live is in a way better, but the Craftsy class at least gives you a chance to reach students you couldn't reach otherwise.
Definitely. And yeah, and I have students from all over the world.
Yes, that too. Yes.
Well, and like you said, with stump work, if you're not filling a class because there's just not enough people in one location that this style is appealing to, this is a great way to reach the stragglers like
yes
me, who, you know, there's, you know, there's no stump work classes where I live. So, you know, to be able to do this is a great thing.
Right.
Christine, you're lucky. Christine, you're lucky if you can find thread where you live.
I know. One would think that's the case. Yeah, I have to order. I order everything online because I can never find anything around here. So,
well, I'm just about in the same shoes as you now, because we moved to a very remote area of Northern California, and most of my needlework supplies I have to order now.
Mm-hmm. You get used to it. You know which stores are easy to order from.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the threads are laid out nicely and you can just plug in what you want. So it really doesn't. I think the only thing that I miss is sort of the camaraderie of having a local shop that, you know, you can go and you know the owners and you know the people that frequent the shop, and uh-huh, so I think that part we miss out on.
And the touching and feeling.
Yes, right.
Yeah, I miss that.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to run out of time, and I want to shift gears, take a complete left turn.
Okay.
You posted a little dissertation the other day, actually by the time this airs 3 weeks ago, about taking some of your pieces to a consignment shop to sell and your thoughts about needlework as art and viewing it that way, that really you really got me thinking and got my wheels spinning about that, because it's one of those discussions. I mean, there's always that question: is it art, or you know, what is it? What is needlework? Is it art? And and I think these days most people have come around to that it is art in some form or another. But then to go sell it and sell it as art is kind of a different leap. And you posted quite a little write up, really got me thinking. How did you get to that point? What was your mental process in getting to the point where, wait, I'm going to go try and sell some of my pieces as art?
Well, you know, most of the time when I'm stitching, and I'm stitching a stump work piece, it's a teaching piece. And when I'm doing that, I have to really be paying attention to what I'm doing. I have to write down all the colors that I'm using. I have to follow a design, or if I'm making changes, I have to write down what the changes are. I have to document all the steps. And so that's all so that I can write instructions up. So if I want to stitch something and not as a gift and not as myself, if I want to just stitch something just for stitching, that's something that I can do that I can sell as artwork. And it's a different type of satisfaction level to stitch and make something than what you get when you're stitching something, designing a piece to teach. And it's also, you know, I think it's the evolution of thinking of myself as an artist. It's been a long time coming, because I, even though I started teaching quite a while ago, it's hard for me to wrap around my head around the idea of I am an artist.
Yeah, that's, that makes sense. Yeah, we don't think of it that way.
Yeah, but see, but I see you as an artist. So that's interesting that in your own head you struggle with that. But, I mean, to me, you are a true artist. I mean, to create what you create and figure out how to make it out of thread, I mean, that's art. And so you have to think it through, too, then. It's interesting.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's... you know, my upbringing was, when you get out of high school, you go to college and you choose a career, and being an artist was never one of those choices.
Right.
You know, and I have a business degree, and I worked in accounting for 15 years. And, you know, doing anything artistic was not a choice when I was growing up. And then I stopped working as an accountant and took care of the kids, and then came around to where I started doing this and thought, okay, this is something that I could do. And, you know, there's a need for stump work teachers. So I always saw myself as a designer and a teacher, but never as an artist. And so I think stitching pieces to show and to sell is more an evolution of thinking of myself more as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's see, that's interesting that you would separate designer and artist. Because to me, they're in many ways, you know, different words for the same thing.
Yeah, I see your point.
Huh. Yeah.
But, I mean, it's just, I think it's just the, you know, how I was raised that.
Well, I think we're all raised like that. You know, go to school, get a degree in something that'll make money and give you a job for the rest of your life. I mean, that's the way baby boomers were raised.
Right. So. Yeah.
Right. And it's easy. Well, and I think the difference between a designer, and maybe that's sort of the stepping stone between, you know, business degree to designer to artist, because business degree is, you know, conventional job, paycheck, all those things. Designer is a little bit more freewheeling. But you're still designing for a job, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're designing something for other people to stitch for fun and for art, but you're still a teacher, so you still have a job. And then to stitch a piece just to sell, now there's the teaching element is gone, the job element is gone, and now it's just purely for the art itself.
Yeah.
So that makes sense as an evolution.
And you know, teaching, it's still a very noble profession, you know. So going from the accounting position to teaching was, you know, at that point in my mind, it's still very acceptable to do that.
Mm-hmm. So are you comfortable with your artist identification now?
I'm beginning to be. It's still a struggle to say I am a textile artist.
And how do you see people accepting this as art? And I imagine it would have to do with partially where you go to sell artwork, right? So
yeah,
people
definitely
are accustomed to buying art in galleries and things like that. So how do you even go about doing that?
Well, I joined an art association that's in the big town close to where I live, and through them I was able to find a store that was looking for people to put pieces on consignment. So Eureka has a very good support network for artists. There are a lot of painting artists and photography artists that are in this area, so moving here has been good for me in that sense, and that they already support artists with showing artwork in stores, not just in galleries.
Yeah.
So you're in the right environment then. Yeah.
Right. I'm in the right environment. Now, if I was still in the Bay Area, I think it would be much more difficult for me still to think of myself as being an artist, because everything is about the job and the money in the Bay Area.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. So this consignment shop then, what'd you take, half dozen pieces and all framed up and put them in the shop and figure out some price? That must have been a challenge, just coming up with a price.
Right. So coming up with a price was one of the hardest things, because I tend to think in terms of, well, nobody's going to pay that much for this piece. But you can't just charge materials. You have to charge for your time.
Yes.
And it has to be a living wage for your time.
Mm-hmm.
And part of why I'm doing this is not so much to sell pieces, but also to show pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm probably the only textile artist that's showing pieces in this area. I mean, there's quilters, and there's a lot of people that work with fibers, you know, like yarns and weaving and knitting and all that kind of stuff. And there's big quilt shows in the area. But in terms of embroidery, I haven't seen any type of embroidery shown anywhere. So I think it will be a while before people begin to accept that what I am doing is art. But I think the more I show pieces, the more I get my pieces out in the public, the more it will become considered art the way I want it to be considered art.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. You know, people are familiar with quilts. They know they know what to expect. And they know what a basic functional quilt is, and then they see, you know, an art quilt, especially some of the, like, the real modern type quilts that are done. You know, it's more obvious that this is, you know, a step above, a level above a functional piece.
Right.
But you're right. Nobody's used to seeing, you know, embroidery is something that your grandmother hangs on their wall. That's what it is. It's never something that you would purchase as a piece of art. I honestly can't think of a single time I've ever seen that done. And maybe partially for exactly the reason that you stated, because it takes so long to do. You know, a machine quilted quilt, even that is nothing compared to even a small stump work piece, because there's so many stitches. It's all by hand. It's, you know, it's extensive. So the piece just by nature has to be somewhat pricey.
Right. So, because if it, you know, if a piece like the craft seat piece probably took me 40 hours to produce, you know, if you're going to charge a decent hourly rate, and then you have to add in your materials and all the different silks that go into it,
right,
it's not going to be inexpensive.
No, but people would buy a painting for that amount of money without batting an
eye. Exactly.
So you're right, it's really just about changing people's perception and changing, sort of opening their eyes to the idea that something else can be looked at the same way that a painting would be, and then then for them to pay that amount of money for that is, you know, becomes natural, but nobody sees it that way. So it's really, I think you're right. And I think that's maybe something that as a community we should all do is get more stump work pieces out, because then people can appreciate them for the artistry that they are. It's a very good point.
And join the different art associations and show your work in galleries next to the oil paintings and the watercolors and the photography.
I think that's a great idea. Yeah, I had not thought of it that way, but I think it's an excellent point, because it's only art when you instruct people to when you twist their eyeballs a little bit to see it that way, right?
Exactly. Yeah, so, exactly.
And it's just a matter of familiarity. So I think it's a really valid point. And something that all of us can do, you know, once we can produce a piece that's worthy, right?
So it's all worthy.
Yes. But it is
all worthy.
I like that idea. I like the idea of bringing it into a different type of audience, because we're used to seeing it like state fairs and things like that. But to be honest, even at our local state fair, it was very reflective of what you would see in a typical needlework shop, which was a few sampler type things, a bunch of counted pieces, maybe one surface piece, and that was it. And there was no stump work to be found anywhere.
Right. Yeah.
So we just need to get out there.
And in the county fair that's here, they had one building that had the needlework plus weaving plus quilting and all the food items. Yeah. And then they had another venue where they had fine art.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And how disappointing and frustrating is that? It must be.
Yeah.
But see, that's the whole thing. I think that's the very crux of it right there. Moving what we do out of the women's work category and into creative artistic world.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're no longer with the baked goods.
Right. So we need to change the perception of what this is.
Yes.
So it's been categorized too long as women's work, like what you said. And we need to change the perception that this is art. And it should be classified with the fine arts.
Well, and see, as a male in this hobby, even more important to me, you know, the social stigma of women's work, and because my dad, who's 84, he lives in another state, and I only get to see him every now and then, and he knew that we were doing the previous podcast that we did for Reef Aquariums, and last time I saw him, he said, "Hey, are you still doing that podcast thing?" And I said, "Well, yeah, but we're not doing it on Reef Aquariums anymore." And he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, on needlework." And he looked at me, he says, "Sewing?" and I said, "Well, no, it's needlework. It's needlepoint and other things." And there was just no way I was ever going to get him to understand. And then, of course, there's that social stigma. You know, what is my son doing sewing? Mm-hmm. And there was no way I was ever going to turn him around, so I moved on to another subject. But but it is that women's work stigma, and for me, as a male, I mean, we've talked in previous podcasts about stitching on an airplane or wherever. I mean, it makes me uncomfortable, because you get those sideways glances, and you do get some people who are truly interested, but you get the others like, what's he doing? And but it's that women's work, you know, I'm putting that in quotes each time, stigma that goes with it versus no, I'm creating art here. You know, no different than if you were sitting with a pencil and a sketch pad and doing a pen and ink drawing. Yes.
You know, and the irony of that is that it's almost like if you think about the sort of the analogy of cooking, right? So you have women cooks and you have men chefs.
Mm-hmm.
And how for
Isn't
a long
that
time
truth?
That was the case, right? And then so there's, you know, and it took for a while, ironically, for women to break into the idea that they could be chefs at, you know, very, very fine restaurants. You don't see as many women chefs at that level, even though every, you know, women are cooking every single day. If you go back to the 17th century, back to the beginning of our conversation, you had women's work doing more of the functional stitchery, right? The embroidery
exactly.
of linens and things and making clothing and stuff like that. And then you had men embroiderers who were doing the finery, who were doing the, you know, the fancy work, the tailoring, the, you know, the liturgical things, all of the fancy things that people would hold up as art. So the men were allowed to make art, and the women were allowed to make the things that we actually use every day.
And you still have, like, in countries like India, where the men are the ones who are doing the embroidery that are done for the clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And the women are not doing the embroidery that's sold. It's only the men, and the men are the tailors.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate, because the embroidery in India, that's something we haven't even talked about on the show at all, is exquisite, some of it. You know, that's
and
a whole area.
It's specialized training.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's totally, that's a whole different, you know, style and fabrics and motifs and all of that. That's something I've been thinking about recently, actually. Because it's something that style appeals to me tremendously. So it is interesting, again, because then it's the men that are expected to produce the finery. And again, the women are just producing functional things.
Right.
So it seems to be always that way. So we just have to twist that back around again. That's all.
Twist around centuries.
Sure. You know, well, hey, it's one gallery and one consignment shop at a time. You know, it's one artist.
Exactly.
You know, artist area, you know, it takes one person, and then one person becomes two people. And then before then it becomes a movement. And then you have, you know, chefs that are women that are, you know, in 5-star restaurants, respected just, you know, the same way that men are. It's just a matter of changing perception of what people are capable of doing. So now we have our work cut out for us.
So that's probably too early in this new venture for you, but do you have a sense that, your work is getting viewed as art? I mean, is it, I could ask the crude question, have you sold anything? But, you know, have you had discussions with people that lead you down that path?
The feedback that I've gotten from the store owner is that she says my work is exquisite. I don't think anything has sold, but I know she and her staff are appreciating it. And my next plan is to put it into an exhibit in the actual in an actual gallery, and we'll see how that goes.
Oh, that would be so much fun to do. To exhibit in a gallery. Oh, that would be just have a little opening.
Well, and you know what's interesting is that historical pieces are in museums quite commonly. Mm-hmm. So if it's old, it's art. If it's new, it's craft.
Yeah, that's true.
So we just need to switch that around as well. You know, if just because it's been sitting around for 200 or 300 years, that makes it art, well, you know, that's something we can change as well.
Humans in their language. It's pathetic.
It's funny little conventions that we've decided, right?
Yeah.
All right, we got to end this thing. Doggone it. Yes, I think you now hold the record for the longest one, Celeste, so yay for you. Yep, I think so. All right, we sure appreciate it, Celeste. Thanks for sharing all that you do and know and enlightening us. Really appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
Yep. All right. With that, we'll end this one. And Christine and I will be back on Wednesday. Thanks for listening.
Take care.